Pitchers and catchers have reported. Now it's your turn. Yahoo Fantasy Baseball leagues are now open. The Yahoo Fantasy app is the number one mobile app in fantasy baseball and the official fantasy game of Major League Baseball. Check out Yahoo Pro Leagues, public leagues where you play for cash. The best part is Yahoo handles all the money for you. No commissioner. Buy in for as little as $20 or as much as $1,000. You can also join a public league for free or create your own league with your friends. Flex your skills as a real GM. Trust your instincts or use access to the advanced analytics. Download the Yahoo Fantasy app or sign up now at yahoo.com/fantasybaseball. Don't miss out on this monster baseball season. There's never been a better time to play. In order to support our show, we'll need the help of some great advertisers. And in order to find great advertisers, we'll need to learn a little bit more about you. So please go to podsurvey.com/the-ringer-mlb-show and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little better. That way we can show advertisers just how great our listeners are. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you choose to enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/theringermlbshow. And if I could spell that out, you can answer a couple questions. That's much easier. And thanks again for your help. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Michael Bauman. I'm a staff writer at the Ringer. I say this every week, but it's true this time. We actually do have a jam-packed show. There's lots of news to get to. Nolan Arenado signing, Miles Michaelis signing an extension, the latest on Bryce Harper and other rumors. I'd encourage you to read Zach Cram's news reaction to the Arenado contract extension, which is now up on theringer.com. The second half of the show is going to be the first in a three-part series about the state of baseball, different trend pieces that we want to talk about. So for the next 3 weeks, the second half of the show will be at least one of us talking to somebody from the world of baseball about big stories going on in baseball at large. So the first is going to be a conversation between Ben and me and Rob Arthur, who you might know from Baseball Prospectus. You might know from his previous appearances on the Ringer MLB show, most recently in 2017. And we're going to talk about the state of quantitative analysis in baseball. So why we think about baseball the way we do, like how our understanding of the game is changing. Rob's a great guest because Ben and Zach and I, we understand the framework of statistical analysis and sabermetrics, but Rob is one of the guys that actually goes out and writes it and advances knowledge. So that makes him a very interesting person to talk to. I hope you enjoy the second half of the show. But first, we got to talk about news. So without any further delay, let's go do that. All right, so there's news, as seems to be traditional for 10 minutes before we actually start recording on Tuesdays this year. Nolan Arenado has signed an 8-year, $260 million contract extension. I am joined by my two close friends, Ben Lindbergh. Ben.
Hello.
And Zach Cram.
Hello.
To discuss this and other baseball news. So, Zach, you actually wrote about the Arenado extension. So why don't you kick us off and tell us what to think about this?
It's, I think, good for both player and team, which is something that we haven't been able to say much this offseason. It's been a lot of, well, this is a steal for the team and it's great for the owners, but not necessarily for the players who are signing those deals. But I think $260 million over 8 years, which is what Arenado got, is a worthy deal. It's what he deserves. It's the highest per year salary in MLB history now. He gets an opt-out after year three. He gets a full no trade clause. So basically, if he wants to stay in Colorado, he can stay in Colorado for almost the rest of his career, which is something kind of special. I think we all support player movement and free agency, and players should be able to exercise that right. But when it works out in this kind of way, it's really nice. The Rockies already did that with Todd Helton, who's the best player in franchise history. And as I mentioned in the piece, this kind of was the opposite course that the Diamondbacks took with Paul Goldschmidt earlier this offseason. They traded Goldschmidt a year before he was set to hit free agency. Arenado was also a year away from free agency, but now he'll be in Denver for a lot longer.
Yeah, the Rockies kind of have a history of locking up their own players, whether it's Helton or Carlos Gonzalez or Charlie Blackmon more recently. They have been willing to spend to keep players in town. And when they've dipped into the free agent market, even when they have spent, it hasn't always gone well. Obviously, there's some notorious failures there, and you figure it's probably more difficult to project how an outsider is going to do in Colorado than someone who's already succeeded there. But Arenado, I think, is one of the best players in baseball, and now he's going to be paid like it. And this means that we can continue to have the debate and discussion about how good a hitter he actually is and whether Coors is distorting his stats or distorting them more than it does for the typical player. And that will continue to be the case, if not for his whole career, then at least it looks like his entire prime.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's in the sort of he's proven himself to be in the Larry Walker zone, where like Coors obviously helps him, but he's a really incredible player otherwise. I like this deal for him. And honestly, one of the reasons I like this a lot is it's a good deal for Arenado, because I think I like this deal for him better than I like the Machado contract for Manny. And that's despite Arenado being slightly older. I don't think this is a unanimous opinion, but I don't think he's quite as good. And because he theoretically didn't have the ability to market himself to other teams, he had less leverage. Although, based on what we've seen with Machado and Harper, maybe Arenado being that special and that necessary to the Rockies might have given him leverage that just hitting the free agent market and saying just selling his services to the highest bidder, maybe that doesn't count for as much as it should anymore. The other thing I like is the early opt-out, because not only does it give him a chance to, if everything goes south in Colorado, to hit the free agent market while he's still got the opportunity to make big money and long term, but it puts pressure on the Rockies to contend for the foreseeable future. Like we saw them just watch DJ LeMahieu walk, and you know, LeMahieu I think is a little bit overrated as a player, but you know, it forces them to treat, you know, Herman Marquez and Brendan Rodgers and Trevor Story a certain way, and keep this core that's made runs to the playoffs the past couple of years together, or else they can't tank, or else Arenado's just going to be gone as soon as his opt out hits. So I like that he's getting paid. He is making, you know, his great grandchildren are going to be super rich money. He is, staying in a place where obviously the situation works for him. I think it's kind of funny that the Yankees were floating the line that, oh, we're going to pass on Machado because we're going to make a run at Arenado next offseason. And, you know, they're taking a little bit of a black eye for this. And I like that it puts pressure on Colorado to contend. So, you know, like Zach said right off the top, this makes sense for everybody. And, I have no, unreserved happiness about this deal for all parties. And I don't remember the last time I said that about a baseball transaction.
The Machado comparison's interesting. I think if you look at the three major public player evaluation models, if you look at FanGraphs, Machado has rated out as about 5 wins better in his career than Arenado. If you look at Baseball Prospectus, Arenado's about 5 wins better than Machado. And if you look at Baseball Reference, they're within a single win above replacement of each other. So I guess you could just like average them out and say they're basically equally valuable players. I think maybe you can predict that they might age a little bit differently. Machado obviously played shortstop last year instead of sticking at third, but they are really similar players. They're both, generationally dominant defenders who, maybe aren't quite as good at hitting as their raw totals will indicate, but are still very good at hitting. So I think the fact that their contracts are pretty similar makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the thing that people use to ding Arenado is, if you look at his road stats, he has a 318 on base percentage away from Coors Field, and his power goes down, his strikeouts go up. He has a 108 WRC plus on the road, so that's just a little bit better than league average. Of course, all players are worse on the road than they are at home. That's going to be particularly true for Rockies players because of how Coors Field functions. And not only is Coors Field a great hitter's park, but there's been various suggestion and evidence that maybe Coors hitters and Rockies hitters have a harder time on the road because they have to deal with the adjustments from how pitches move in one place and how pitches move when they're not at altitude. And so it seems like there's maybe a bigger than usual adjustment there. And we've seen with some hitters who've gone from Coors to other places, like Matt Holiday, for instance, where everyone said, oh, he's a product of Coors Field, and then he went elsewhere. And when he was playing full time for another team, he was just fine and adjusted and was as good as ever. So I think that's very possible. And regardless, his glove is great wherever he is. He's a really excellent player. And I think with the Machado contract, you could look at it and say, well, Machado's kind of buying low on the Padres. He's getting in on the ground floor of this team that's probably about to be really good, given how great its farm system is. I don't know that you can forecast that with the same confidence for the Rockies. I don't know if they're set up quite as well as, say, the Padres are long term. But Arenado, having him in the fold obviously helps. When you have a player like that locked up, then you have to do less to actually build a contender. So
yeah, it's the hardest thing to do is to get a player like that.
Right. So, and they've done a great job of developing their own players and this homegrown rotation that they have now. So if they finally figured out how to pitch at Coors Field, then hitting's the thing they really have to solve, kind of paradoxically. You'd think that would be easier there, but that's where they've been weakest lately, is with offensive production. So you really have to keep Arenado in the fold. He's your best hitter and best position player.
All right, let's move on, because there actually is a lot of news that's broken in the past day or so. This is another Zach Cram favorite. Miles Michaelis has signed a four-year, $68 million extension with the St. Louis Cardinals. And Zach, I think you just said it in Slack, you wonder how many lizards can you buy for $68 million? So why don't you know, what are your first impressions of this deal?
I really like Miles Michaelis. I actually wrote about him in the middle of last year. I think we gave it a cheeky headline that was like, he's like the best starting pitcher to come over from Japan this year. Michaelis had been a pitcher for the Padres and the Rangers earlier this decade and wasn't very good, went to Japan and kind of remade himself. And the thing I like about him is that he just throws strikes. And I think especially in today's game, as guys don't have to work as long into games, strikeouts are rising, three-true outcomes are rising, Michaelis isn't a big strikeout pitcher, but he just puts the ball in the zone and makes batters hit it. His first strike percentage last year was over 70%, which among starting pitchers was number one in all of baseball. Two through five were Aaron Nola, Luis Severino, Justin Verlander, and Zach Greinke. So he's not at their level as a pitcher. He doesn't get the strikeouts that those aces do, but he's a very good pitcher. He had the lowest walk rate of any qualified starter last year. And this is a good amount of money for someone with his kind of track record. But if I were the Cardinals, I'd be pretty confident in his performance after his first year back in the States.
Yeah, that's the Cardinals' confidence in him is the most interesting thing to me, because he just turned 30 last summer. He's not a big strikeout guy, like you said. Four for 68 is a not insubstantial amount of money for a pitcher who, it's wild that 6.5 strikeouts per nine innings is unimpressive for a starting pitcher in this day and age, but it is. I think it's fine, but particularly because he also threw 200 innings, which is nearly as anomalous as the other numbers that he put up. But yeah, I think it's, I'm not making a value judgment about this, but that they're making a commitment to him shows that they have confidence that the performance that he put up wasn't some sort of mirage. And I think that's the most interesting thing about this.
Yeah. And you could lump another extension in that camp that I know we want to talk about, Aaron Hicks, who just signed a 7-year, $70 million contract with the Yankees. And he's another guy who has kind of come out of nowhere later than players typically do. And obviously the Yankees expect that to continue, although this deal is not necessarily paying him like the player who was a 5-win guy last year. But he's someone who came from the Twins after years of scuffling and being a prospect and never fulfilling his potential. And over the last couple seasons since he's been with the Yankees, you know, he was a 3-win guy in just over half a season in 2017, and then again a 5-win guy last year. He's been good defensively. He's been about 25% better than the league average hitter. He's probably the biggest reason that the Yankees have not pursued a Bryce Harper this offseason, when maybe they could have otherwise, because their outfield is so crowded, and you wouldn't have expected Aaron Hicks to be the guy standing in the way of that union. But he really has become kind of an unsung star. I mean, I know it's difficult when you're an an outfield that at least sometimes includes Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge. So you're flanked by two literal and figurative giants of the game. But Aaron Hicks doesn't quite have the star power, but you can see why the Yankees would want to commit to him, because he really has shown that he could fulfill the promise that he had as a prospect.
Zach, what are your thoughts on this deal?
I think Aaron Hicks is, I guess, first off, a good example of how player development is not a linear process. It's something we talk about, mm-hmm. but Aaron Hicks was a really good prospect. And just because he failed upon first reaching the major leagues isn't reason to give up on a guy. I think we've been spoiled with players like Mike Trout and Juan Soto and Ronald Acuna, who are just really phenomenal major league players as soon as they reach the majors. But that doesn't work for everyone. And Aaron Hicks kind of is taking the path that might be more of an old time path, where he struggles upon first reaching the majors, but then he gets better and he gets better. And now he's a year away from free agency. And even if he's not reaching free agency, he's still cashing in. And I think it's nice to see like different paths kind of work out. He's not a superstar like Arenado, and this isn't necessarily paying him like he might make on the open market, but $70 million is not a small amount of money for someone with Hicks's major league track record. So I think I lean toward this one being team friendly, just because, like, even if he's bad, $10 million a year is like middle reliever money at this point. So it leans team friendly for the Yankees, but I certainly understand why Hicks would want to sign it.
It's interesting, like, a contract this long, 7 years and eight if you count the option, for only $10 million a year, is it like the combination of 7 years, $70 million feels like something out of 1998. And, you know, his track record isn't that long. He turns 30 in October. And so you can understand why he'd be willing to take this as opposed to testing out the market. I just wanted to second what you said about the player development thing, because he was like, when the Twins had that really impressive farm system, I guess around 2013 or so, like, the idea was that he was sort of the George Springer to Miguel Sano and Byron Buxton's Carlos Correa and Alex Bregman. I'm not 100% sure that metaphor works, but like, he was like supposed to be the third guy, you know, the third all-star with the two guys who became MVP candidates, or were supposed to. And I'm just, I don't know, I'm thinking back about how I guess I compared Miguel Sano to Alex Bregman, when you can probably fit three Alex Bregmans inside one Miguel Sano. And so he went from that kind of prospect to, I don't know, around 2014, 2015. I was somebody who was high on Hicks as a minor leaguer, and I was thinking, should he stop switch hitting? Should he become a pitcher? Like, that was the level of just offensive incompetence that he was showing. So, you know, good for him that he's getting paid. You'd like to see somebody with this track record get a little bigger piece of the pie, although looking at what free agency's done, you know, this might be part of the knock-on effect, right? That that players are looking at what's happening to guys like Marwin Gonzalez, who we're going to talk about in a second, having trouble finding work. And, you know, maybe he just wants to lock in. And maybe this is something like the Arenado situation, where he's just found a situation that he likes, that it works for both player and team, and they want to stay together for the next 7 years in this case. So he's had a really interesting career, and he's capping it off with a really interesting contract extension. Let's talk about Marwin Gonzalez, a favorite of mine. I don't know if he's a favorite of the entire podcast, but he signed a 2-year, $21 million deal. It's slightly front-loaded to go to the Twins. We talked about the Twins having sort of a mixed offseason. I think they made a lot of good moves. I just don't think that they made the move that's going to allow them to really put pressure on Cleveland. And as much as I like Marwin Gonzalez and as many holes as he fills for that team, they need something like the Byron Buxton breakout season that we're waiting on. Like, Buxton had an incredible game yesterday, and, you know, I know better, but part of me is still like, oh, but what if, you know, what if the MVP potential is still in there? Like, they need something like that in order to contend with Cleveland.
Yeah, I think they could have used a pitcher, because this rotation after Jose Berríos is a little scary. I know Kyle Gibson was very good last year, but there are definitely some question marks toward the back end there. And if you could put Dallas Keuchel in this rotation, that would really change things.
They still could.
Yeah, they could. And most of the additions they've made to this point have been on the offensive side. And yeah, they're probably not going to go anywhere unless they get something from Buxton and Sano, and we can all write our Buxton breakout articles for the fourth consecutive spring or whatever it is. But I am sort of surprised that this was presumably the best that Marwin Gonzalez could get, 2 years and $21 million, because at the outset of the offseason, he seemed like someone everyone was interested in. And because you can kind of pencil him in at any position and every position, he's a fit for every team, just about. You know, you could really, there isn't a single team in baseball that couldn't fit Marwin Gonzalez in somewhere. And we've seen so many teams prioritize having a Marwin Gonzalez type. Like, he's kind of become an archetype at this point. And so maybe teams just felt like they didn't need the brand name or the original at this point, because they can just kind of manufacture their own. We've just seen a lot of teams take guys who played one or two positions and say, well, why couldn't he play four or five positions, which is sort of the Marwin Gonzalez career path. And so maybe he has just popularized this model so much, along with Ben Zobrist and others, that teams just didn't feel like they needed any particular one guy with the skill set when they could just create their own. So that seems to be what happened here. Otherwise, you would have expected him to do better than this financially.
Yeah, paradoxically, it seems like the guys that every team could use, and it's Harper, Machado, Kimbrel, and Marwin, or, you know, obviously Marwin's not that level of player. He's not a future Hall of Famer, but he's useful to just about every team. Paradoxically, they've been the last assigned. Zach, has Marwin Gonzalez inspired an archetype that has rendered him unable to cash in?
Possibly. I think it's kind of strange, because if you look at other areas where teams would think they're able to manufacture sort of their own guys, develop their own players, you'd look at something like the relief corps, because basically every minor league system now has, you know, maybe it's a failed starter, but you put him into relief and he can throw a 98 mile an hour fastball and a wicked slider and become a great reliever. It seems like every team has four or five of those guys on their roster at this point, but, you know, huge exception of Kimbrel aside, teams are still paying for relievers. Adam Ottavino and Zach Britton and Andrew Miller and Joe Kelly for the Dodgers have all received pretty fair contracts this winter. So teams are still paying for proven relievers, even though they can manufacture their own. So it's kind of strange that they wouldn't be paying for these proven multi-position guys when it's not entirely clear if they can manufacture their own at this point. Like, maybe Jeff McNeil works out in New York, and maybe DJ LeMahieu proves able to play a lot of positions in the other New York stadium, but they haven't done it before. Whereas Gonzalez and, you know, Josh Harrison, who signed like a 1 year, $2 million deal with the Tigers, and he can play multiple positions. It's kind of off-putting that the guys who are able to do it haven't been paid like it.
And speaking of players who can play multiple positions, I know when this news broke, my mind, yes, and Zach's mind also went to what the implications for Williams Astudillo are, because there was already some doubt about whether Astudillo would have a spot on the opening day roster, and Marwin Gonzalez's presence doesn't make that any more secure. So I would be very sad if more Marwin means less Williams Astudillo.
Okay, I guess that means that, I mean, obviously I am, my primary concern in all things is what it means for Williams Astudillo.
Yes.
But we got to talk about Bryce Harper, who is still not signed. I was sort of holding out hope that he would sign on the eve of, like, an hour before the podcast, like Manny Machado did last week. Let me share with you the two last outside installments into the Bryce Harper conversation in Ringer MLB Slack. It is Smash Mouth tweeting that Giants ownership might not be on the same page as Farhan Zaidi regarding Harper. They want to offer a long-term contract like they did with Bonds, and Zaidi does not want to. And then we have John Morosi, a more traditional source of baseball news, saying that Bryce Harper might prefer the Dodgers to the Phillies, in part because he's a Lakers fan. And friends... friends, I've been on this carousel for a long time, and I just want it to end. This is too much. This is just ridiculous. I am very close to handing this podcast over to you guys completely and going over to Justin Verrier and saying, can I just write about basketball full time? Because in the absence of news, horseshit has bubbled up from the surface through the molten mantle of the earth to fill the void. And I can't even get my metaphor straight. So
John Middleton Plane Watch was okay, but the Smash Mouth tweet broke you.
I don't know. Like, Plane Watch is sort of par for the course for college baseball fan, or not college baseball, college basketball fan. Not basketball. Zach! Football! College football fans, because they're, you know, you're constantly, you know, following the University of Oregon's university jet to see if it's going to Alabama to pick up Mario Cristobal or whatever. And so, like, that doesn't even register. John Middleton as a cigar billionaire is sort of such an inherently ridiculous figure to me that nothing he does sort of sets off those kind of alarm bells. And, you know, I'm not saying that Bryce Harper owes it to anybody, or that Scott Boras owes it to anybody to get anything but the best deal for his client, no matter how annoying it is to the rest of us. This is just the... In the absence of actual forward motion on negotiations, we're just all like reading the tea leaves here. And I think everybody's just going a little bit stir crazy. So I don't know. I think he gets 10 years and upwards of $300 million. I think he gets more per year than Arenado. I think he gets more total than Machado. You know, I don't know if he hits that. Well, I guess the Stanton contract would be less per year, but even though it's $325 million, you know, I think he gets that record-breaking contract. I still think it more likely than anywhere else it's Philadelphia, just because it doesn't, you know, nobody else has been linked to making that kind of offer. But I think Scott Boras is just making absolutely sure that nobody else is gonna swoop in at the last minute like the Padres did with Machado and beat the best offer. I'm kind of frustrated with the Phillies for not just ending it. You know, I'm sure there's a dollar value where if they hit it, then it just ends everything and we all move on with our lives. But I want to know where he's going to play. I want to know whose uniform he's going to be in on the cover of MLB The Show, which is apparently still up in the air. And we're like running up against the deadline at that point. So, you know, it's just better for everybody's mental health if everybody signs in December like they used to. And, you know, I am not going to miss this when there's a strike. I will say that much.
Yes, I went to a preview event for the new MLB The Show the other day, and I mentioned, I bet you guys probably want Harper to sign sometime soon, huh? And there was some nervous laughter, definitely. So, I mean, from an entertainment perspective, I much prefer Plane Watch to Instagram Watch and who's followed who and who's liking whose posts, which obviously was never very telling. Like you, I think he will probably do well. I think he'll probably get 10 years. I think he'll probably surpass Machado. Total guaranteed money. If it were me, I'd rather have Machado as a player than Harper, I think. But it seemed all along that Harper might get more. Maybe it's just because of the name value. I don't know. And now, obviously, he has the Machado contract as something to aim for and try to beat. So that could help, too. I also think that the Phillies make the most sense here. I mean, it's not just the stupid money comment of John Middleton that now has put the pressure on the Phillies to make good on that promise. But I think just from an on-the-field standpoint, I mean, sure, Harper would make the Dodgers better. He'd make the Giants better. But I think he really would make the Phillies better, not just because he's, you know, replacing someone who is far worse wherever he...
Nick Williams,
yeah,
probably,
basically. Yeah. But also because of that division and that competitive situation. I mean, the Giants are probably not a playoff team this year, even with Harper. The Dodgers are almost certainly a playoff team this year without Harper. With the Phillies, I think you can make a case that Harper really does swing their odds significantly from non-playoff to playoff, or having to fight it out all season long with the other NLS teams to possibly being the favorite, or at least being up there with anyone else. So I think all signs point to the Phillies. And yeah, you can say, why don't they just end this? But there are multiple parties involved here. And who knows, maybe Harper prefers to play somewhere else, all else being equal. I can't imagine that it has anything to do with his basketball fandom. I can buy that Mike Trout might want to go to Philly because he loves Philly.
Say,
but anyone else, I just don't know whether they have a deep enough connection to a city or team to make this decision based on wanting to watch the Lakers in person.
Yeah, I was going to say, if nothing else, Mike Trout has proved that you can live on the opposite side of the country, and if you make enough money, you can fly back and buy front row tickets whenever you want. I think he makes more. I think there's name recognition. I think there's a Boris factor that, you know, maybe Boris is more more interested in setting records. So he's going to drive a little bit of a harder bargain just to make sure that he wrings every last dollar out of it, which is what makes him the best agent in the business. And I also think that with a deal this big, there is like, this is not a deal that the GM or the president of baseball ops makes. This is a deal this big is something that the owner has to sign off on. And I think this is at play with the Phillies that I don't know if Matt Klentak or Andy McPhail values Harper greater or more than Machado. In fact, I think I would be a little concerned if they did, but it's possible that John Middleton, the controlling owner of the Phillies, does. And that's what's going to be the deciding factor, or, you know, the ownership of the Dodgers or the Giants or whoever he ends up signing with. I think at some point in the past week, and it might have come before this, it might have been plain watch, it might have been the Smash Mouth comment, but at some point we just passed. There's just no more meaning to be squeezed out of this until a contract gets signed. So, oh boy. At what point do we worry about the late start to spring training impacting Bryce Harper as a player? Like, we saw this with Marwin Gonzalez, for instance, he said he hadn't faced live pitching all winter because he didn't want to get hit and get hurt until he signed a contract. And we've seen things, you know, with like dating as far back as the Stephen Drew signing. The longer you wait, there's a certain point in free agency where past that point, if you're not in camp, it affects you for the first half of the season at the very least. So, Zach, you know, are you concerned about running up against a deadline like that?
I have not seen any reporting actually on how Bryce is training this offseason. I assume he is, and I don't think it's gotten to the point that it was last year and that it was in like 1995, as Ben wrote about, where there are enough remaining free agents that they're actually sort of forming their own ad hoc spring training camp. I think I'm a little less concerned for a position player like Bryce than I am for a pitcher. Maybe that doesn't fit with the history of the thing, like you mentioned with Stephen Drew or Kendrys Morales was that same year.
It explains why Lance Lynn wasn't the best pitcher in baseball the first half of last year.
Yeah, I think
it
just...
admit that.
It just takes a little, I guess it's a little more intuitive to me that a pitcher would struggle a bit more to like get up to full speed than a position player, but I'm not entirely sure why I believe that. So who knows, maybe Bryce will end up signing for like $330 million and have a bad April and everything will burn down even further because he won't be living up to his contract right
away. It can always get worse.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think for a pitcher, just having to ramp up from inactivity to midseason workloads, that's probably something that's best done under the supervision of a team and not on a rushed schedule. I mean, it's 1 year ago to the day that J.D. Martinez signed with the Red Sox, and obviously that late signing didn't seem to hurt him any at the plate. That's just one data point, but I also think that if he signs sometime in the next week, let's say, I wouldn't expect that to hamper him in the season. And Boris does, of course, have a huge training facility where maybe you can't face major league pitching, but you can probably do everything else that one would do in spring training. So I wouldn't be too concerned about it.
All right. One last thing. There's a rumor, a report, an actual newspaper article by Jason Rees of the Long Beach Post. Sorry, I've been paying attention to the Bryce Harper saga so long, I forgot that there was like actual news that happened. The Angels are apparently in talks to move to a downtown stadium in Long Beach for the 2021 season. Obviously, this feels like a play to get a better deal or stadium upgrades or a new ballpark in Anaheim. I like this because I think it should be a rule that the Angels have to either move or change their city name once every 8 years at the absolute maximum.
Yeah, I hope this doesn't, was this Long Beach? I mean, they've now switched to Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, right? So I hope we wouldn't have to go to...
No, it's just Los Angeles Angels now.
Just, yeah, I think you're
right. We
talked
about this, didn't notice that they dropped
That's
the Anaheim.
That's right, they dropped the Anaheim. So I hope this doesn't mean that they would have to then add of Long Beach to the end. Hopefully they would just drop one entirely. This probably has more ramifications for our LA colleagues at the Ringer who might be going to Angels games.
They seem
or not
to be in favor. Yeah. Yeah, Bill is in favor of them moving to Long Beach. I think Kevin Clark spoke up in favor of them going down to Long Beach. They seem to like Long Beach more than Anaheim. I've never been to either. Zach, you're the only one of us who has actually lived in Southern California. Do you have any thoughts on where the Angels would be better suited playing?
Anaheim's like really far from everything else. So that's like not in its favor, I think. Like, I ventured down there last year, of course, because I wanted to see Trout. I wanted to see Ohtani, but it's really far and hard to get everywhere. I'm not sure if going to Long Beach would improve either of those factors, but I think if they end up moving, I would actually like to see them change their name to the Long Beach Angels, just because I like having diversity and like quirky city names and sports teams. Like, the fact that there's a Green Bay football team is nice because, you don't have every team name as just the same cities in every single sport. So I think it's nice to have diversity, and I'm in favor of it, like you, just for that reason that doesn't actually affect any of us who would have to live with it.
All right. So that, I mean, this is shockingly a rather jam-packed news segment. So we're going to take a quick break, and then Ben and I are going to talk to Rob Arthur about the state of the statistical, or the state of the art in baseball statistics. We'll be back again after these messages. Pitchers and catchers have reported. Now it's your turn. Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Leagues are now open. The Yahoo Fantasy app is the number one mobile app in fantasy baseball and the official fantasy game of Major League Baseball. Check out the Yahoo Pro Leagues, public leagues where you play for cash. The best part is Yahoo handles all the money for you. No commissioner. Buy in for as little as $20 or up to $1,000. You can also join a public league for free or create your own league with your friends. The new weekly scoring format makes it even easier to run your team all season. So flex your skills as a real GM, trust your instincts, or use access to analytics. Find your sleepers or stash some minor league talent. The top 10 prospects for each MLB team are available. Use the Set Active Players feature to set your lineup for the week in just one tap. Download the Yahoo Fantasy app or sign up now at yahoo.com/fantasybaseball. Create your own league, join a public league, or renew your league from last year. Just don't miss out on this monster baseball season. There's never been a better time to play Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. And now, back to the Ringer MLB show with Ben Lindberg and Rob Arthur. All right, so this next segment, for the first time in a while, includes a guest. And what a guest he is. He is Rob Arthur, whose work you might know from places such as 538 and Baseball Prospectus. He is a freelance smart guy and expert on data in baseball. So we're going to kick off this conversation by talking about the state of statistics and data analysis in baseball right now. So, Rob, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is we'll follow this conversation wherever it goes, but the one thing I'm kind of curious about is how far are we from the statistical orthodoxy of 5 years ago or 10 years ago? How fast is the state of the art changing?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's changing pretty quick just because of the advent of StatCast data that enables you to answer a lot of questions that you couldn't necessarily or couldn't easily answer before. And so I think, though, that has in some ways opened up the possible orthodoxy, because whereas before we were sort of limited in what we could do, now, at least in front offices, they're able to take all this new data and apply it to different questions that would have been kind of off limits before. In the public domain, we're still kind of limited, right? We're still limited to just the initial launch characteristics. So the exit velocity of the batted ball, the horizontal and vertical angle. So it's still kind of kept us sort of restrained in terms of what we can do. But I still think there are some challenges to what the orthodoxy was before. I hate to say my own work, but one of the things that I'm most proud of in the last few years is the work I did on hot streaks with Greg Matthews. And we were looking at whether player performance is variable within a year, which has long been a kind of a element of sabermetric orthodoxy. And we found that it is variable, that pitchers are sometimes on and they're sometimes off. And so that's a good example, I think, of challenging orthodoxy. I still think that if you asked 10 sabermetricians, whether pitcher performance is variable, they would mostly say no. But it's still a kind of a new use of data to push back on an old element of dogma.
I was going to ask you about that public-private knowledge gap, because in a lot of ways there is parity in that there's more StatCast information coming out all the time. On the other hand, you have many of the best analysts in the public sphere getting hired by teams at seemingly an accelerating pace. And then you also have new data, whether it's in the minor leagues, whether it's wearable information, whether it's minor league TrackMan, that is really playing a big role when it comes to player development and tweaking players to get the most out of them, that is kind of opaque to the public right now. And so it seems like that's potentially a challenge for projection systems, for instance, which are based on, say, the last 3 years of a player's performance. But those last 3 years might not be so predictive if the player is making some change with the aid of technology that we don't know about until the games begin.
Yeah, I think that, so I've worked on both sides of the public-private data gap, and I currently consult for a team. So it is a really huge difference between what's available in public and what's not. In the major leagues, it's kind of the gap is smaller because MLB through Baseball Savant is publishing some of the information that front offices use. It's still kind of a fairly restricted subset of all the information that they get. But at least some is out there. In the minors and for amateurs, that's where the gap is largest and most significant. And that's where I would expect projection systems to, at least publicly available projection systems, to struggle the most, right? Information in the minors is very useful, I can say that. And none of that is getting out to the public. Nobody knows what a given minor leaguer's exit velocity is unless he makes has a cup of coffee in the majors. So that is really the kind of the biggest point of departure between the public and the front office data landscape. And on top of that, as you mentioned, they're also collecting other stuff that might be team specific, that's not necessarily in part of StatCast. So, I mean, there was a great series of stories in the recent past about the Boston Red Sox neuroscouting and how they're collecting information on things like reaction time and brain activity of their hitters potentially. And so that kind of information will probably never enter the public domain. And I don't know we don't know generally whether that's predictive or not. But the fact that teams are investing in collecting data on neural activity and biomechanics and all sorts of other things suggests that it probably is valuable. So I think if the projections are ever going to kind of keep pace, if the public projections are going to keep pace with the private landscape, they're going to have to start pricing in the idea that teams actually have more information than they do. And so if a player, for example, gets called up from the minors unexpectedly based on his minors hitting, maybe that's indicative that they know something about the player that's not yet, available in public. And maybe that should kind of shade us towards believing that the player will do better than we would have thought before. So I think we'll have to kind of lean on that information gap and understand that when a team makes a decision, it might be based on data that we just can't see.
That raises all sorts of interesting questions. Now, I think the difference between what the teams know and what the public knows, or what analysts know, or what agents know, is that information asymmetry is, I don't know if it's new, but it's certainly, I think it's safe to say it's greater than it was 10 years ago, when everybody was just sort of, figuring out the second wave of sabermetrics for the first time. And that leads me into something that, one direction I wanted to chase this conversation is StatCast is sort of the league's public face for this next generation of stats. And it's very cool what they do. The system is very, very advanced in the ability to track player speed and location and batted ball direction and velocity is all incredibly impressive, but it feels like it's being pitched, at least by the league, as something more than what's actually being released. Like, the data that's being gathered is being used by teams to do what we would probably consider to be science, or at least social science. But what we see as far as the public is, not as useful. We're not getting all the information. And so, like, when they say, something like catch probability feels more to me like trivia than something that we can actually, use to draw conclusions about a player. Is that assumption off base?
No, I think you're exactly right. And I really like the way that you described it as more like trivia than actual, you know, useful scientific information. I think that's a very conscious choice on the part of people that run teams. They, you know, they have seen work that they've done privately end up in public just because people in public have, you know, independently reinvented it. And so there is kind of an incentive for the most forward-thinking teams to keep the StatCast information that gets released to a minimum, and to keep what is released kind of at the level of trivia and fun facts and interesting things, but not really enough for you to develop any kind of predictive model or do any real science. And so I think that that has been a limitation and a factor. And as a result, the stuff that does come out, it's, in some ways, it's kind of opaque what goes into catch probability. There are some explanations, and I don't want to minimize the work that they've done to tell us about catch probability, but there are still some kind of missing bits, and they don't give us the data that ends up being part of the catch probability calculation, like where the distance between where a fielder started and where he caught the ball and where the ball landed, for example. Those are the elements that go into catch probability, and so we can kind of see them being reflected in what comes out, but they're not actually giving us the numbers. And if we had the numbers, we might be able to build our own better version of catch probability or build something that is more closely aligned with what a front office has. And so if you're in a front office, you don't want people in the public doing that and diminishing your advantage. So you keep it quiet and you try and persuade the people at MLBAM not to release that information directly, at least potentially. I should say I'm not aware of any specific instance of this happening. However, I think there are strong incentives for them to do that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, the gap is kind of large there, and it's, I think, on purpose.
And this is an era where it's difficult to evaluate defense because of all the shifting alignments that teams are using. You have to account for the player's starting position. So do you think that the defensive metrics available from MLB Advanced Media are the state of the art, are the best we can do currently? I know that you've done some work of your own on using some of that information to inform defensive metrics and using some of the exit velocity and launch angle calculations to improve batted ball metrics. But you also work at Baseball Prospectus, which has rolled out stats like deserved run average for pitchers and deserved runs created for hitters that seem to do a good job of, you know, assessing and projecting performance without necessarily incorporating that StatCast information. So what is the best that we can rely on right now?
So I guess I would say that the public metrics that are available from MLBAM, like catch probability, they're probably the best that we have right now. The metric that I made that you're referring to is called LARS, and I haven't continued to publish it because there was not much demand for it. And I don't know how it would stack up against catch probability, but I think that generally the advantage that catch probability has is more data. And because that data isn't getting released publicly, we sort of have to rely on that output that that we do have. The big limitation for catch probability is that my understanding right now is it's still only in the outfield. And the infield is a much more difficult beast to model because there are a lot more moving parts and a lot more players involved in a given play. And the infield is also where traditional defensive metrics have struggled. So I think in the outfield, definitely catch probability is the most advanced just by virtue of having data that no other metric has. In the infield, we're still sort of stuck with what we have always had. And I don't, you know, there hasn't been much effort to bring in things like sprint speed that might help infield modeling in the public domain. So I think there's kind of a room for improvement. But right now, sort of catch probability is the best we can do, at least in the outfield.
One thing that I think is kind of relevant now, because we saw the Nolan Arenado contract just broke today. We're waiting for Bryce Harper to sign somewhere. And those are two players where, for good or ill, defense has played a lot into their war total, you know, or their overall evaluation of the player. And one thing that I think maybe gets advanced stats in trouble a little bit is the illusion of greater precision than actually exists, because war goes to a tenth of a win, for instance, or, you know, they publish data down to a particular to a specific run saved over the course of a season over across the various defensive metrics. So it's my question is how, and we see, you know, even great defenders like Andrelton Simmons gets, you know, his defensive value swings by a couple wins from season to season in extreme cases. So I guess my question is, regardless of which system is best, how accurate are we talking about? Like in your head, do you have to make a, if, you know, you're actually saying this is how good Bryce Harper is, we say, I don't know, I trust the defensive metrics to within a win, to within five runs, something, you know, what's the margin of error that you sort of heuristically go with?
Well, I think on wins above replacement, generally the commonly accepted and what I found in my own research number is plus or minus one win. So if you see Harper with seven wins, then it's really between six and eight. For defenses, and I would say the majority of that is because of uncertainty in measuring defense. Before we had catch probability, we really had very limited ways of telling what the difficulty in making a defensive play was. So it was really hard to say that, you know, a given ball hit to the outfield was a sure out or a sure hit. It was sort of like a lot of ambiguity in that zone. And so given that most batted balls are in one of those categories, and there's really only a few dozen batted balls per season to an outfielder that his own skill makes a big difference in, that's where a lot of the error comes from and a lot of the uncertainty. So I think that you could say, I think probably conservatively, that our metrics are only accurate, or at least our total value metrics are only accurate to within a win. And the majority of that is, like I said, the defensive element of it. It gets even more complicated, as I mentioned before, for infielders where, like I said, no play is isolated or as isolated as most outfield plays are, where it's just one guy who can either run and get to the ball quick enough and make the catch or not. In the infield, you have runners to worry about. You have, you know, the turf, and you have all these different things. So there, I would say it's maybe even a little bit larger than a win. So for someone like Andrelton Simmons, maybe it's like plus or minus 1.5 wins. And when you get to that degree of uncertainty, it really becomes difficult to put much stock into any single season's defensive metrics, right? You have to look over the course of players' last few years, sometimes last 3 years, is a kind of a demarcation that people have used before to look at defensive metrics. And only at that point do you kind of get any kind of meaningful, specific information about Bryce Harper versus some random outfielder. There's just so much uncertainty built into that. And I think that the uncertainty is really, I think, arguably where the new information that only front offices have helps the most, because they're able to quantify play difficulty in a way that's much more advanced than what we can do. And I would say probably even than what the public-facing metrics like catch probability can do.
And just to follow up on that real quick, in order to have precision, like we see this with different, the three major different calculations of WAR, like in order to get that level of precision, you have to sort of make some methodological choices too, like how you want to define defensive value or overall value, you know, using an ERA estimator versus runs allowed, you know, something like that. So how do you go about making those methodological decisions, and, you know, is it possible to have some, the holy grail is the grand unified theory of WAR. I just don't know if that's even possible to nail it down, just because there are multiple questions to ask, you know, when you're trying to determine a player's total value.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the methodological choices, a lot of times they stem from ultimately philosophical choices. So like Fangraph's WAR is based on fielding independent pitching, which is methodologically, it only considers the events that we most understand are part of a pitcher's control. But at the same time, that choice was originally made because those events are most predictive of a player's future wins above replacement. So there's a philosophical choice there to kind of make Fangraph's WAR arguably more predictive than something else like Baseball Reference WAR that considers the entire totality of a player's, of a pitcher's events, but might not be as predictive for the future. So those methodological choices, because they stem from these philosophical ones down the line, They're not, you know, sort of outside the scope of a question you can answer numerically or quantitatively. It just depends on what you're designing your statistic for. You want it to be predictive? Do you want it to describe what happened? I would argue that the person that has best approached it is Jonathan Judge at Baseball Prospectus, because he's actually tried to quantify the extent to which his statistics are predictive and descriptive and reliable, meaning do they capture a player's true ability from season to season? And he's tried to basically argue that his statistics are best at all three. And I think in most cases they are. And so, you know, there's no one right philosophical way to approach it, because the Fangraphs guys could say, well, we would prefer that our metric is best at predicting and not necessarily as good at describing what happened. But that's just kind of, like I said, it's unanswerable. It's outside any question that you could calculate, you know, run some numbers and figure out, oh, well, it should be 70% predictive and 30% descriptive. It's just kind of up to the creator of the statistic, what they want it to be. And that kind of guides all the other methodological choices they make in deciding how the statistic will be computed.
I want to ask whether you think we need to change anything about the way certain statistics are calculated or presented to account for the opener and changes in pitcher usage and bullpen usage specifically. For instance, last year there was the case of Ryan Yarbrough with the Rays, who was used as their bulk guy, as they called it. He pitched in 38 games, 147 and a third innings, and he started 6 games. He finished 3 games. He was all over the place. He was usually pitching more like a starter, but I believe, according to Fangraphs, where he was judged as a reliever, which is a higher baseline, so that hurt his WAR as a result. So in the way that last spring, I know that a bunch of stat sites were scrambling to prepare for Shohei Ohtani and the first true two-way player in a century, and I think Baseball Reference actually changed its WAR calculation to account for players like him. Do we need to do anything to just make some adjustments for the fact that the opener will probably be more widespread this year than it was last year? And in the second half of last season, it was already seemingly spreading everywhere.
And if so, can you persuade the guy who runs my Diamond Mine League to be a little less tight with the innings restrictions for starting pitchers? Because we're running into trouble with this.
Yeah, I do think that definitely the WAR calculations are going to have to be revised. I wish there was kind of a general, you know, uniform theory for how to evaluate pitchers regardless of the innings that they pitch. There's long been a problem with evaluating relievers, which is that they pitch more important innings on average than starters. And so that's been kind of a confounder for a long time. But as long as you were judging relievers as a group against each other and starters as a separate group, that was easier to manage. Now we have this whole situation where the distinction between relievers and starters is blurring into each other, and it's really hard to tell. And people have argued to go to the term outgetters, which is kind of unwieldy. I prefer just pitchers because we have that term already. And I just wish that there was a way of kind of bringing all the different types of pitchers together and judging them on a uniform playing field. But that in and of itself will require the kinds of philosophical choices that I mentioned before, which is, you know, how do you want to be judging them, and how do you want to calculate WAR so that it is either describing what happened and giving more credit to guys that pitched higher leverage, or alternately telling what someone will do in the future. And so that's where it gets really tricky. And I do think that they're going to have to be revisions happening more rapidly. Like you mentioned, Baseball Reference updating their WAR calculation. I think it's just going to take a lot more active work on the part of all three of the big sites and anybody else that wants to enter into it to revise how they're calculating WAR to deal with whatever the newest front office tricks are. I mean, I'm sure the opener trick that you mentioned will be used more often next season, but after that, it'll be something else, and there'll be, you know, some other kind of new interesting maneuver that they put into place that will confound the system. So it's whoever is maintaining these just has to be kind of wary and on the lookout and ready to adjust the moment that teams come up with these new things.
I'm going to ask you a talk about question, and I apologize in advance for doing that. But it seems to me that One of the biggest changes in public sabermetrics over the, I don't know, the past 10 years or so has been the movement from sort of operating off of what you get with in a box score to all the stuff that we can do now with tracking and Statcast and everything like that. And as the data's gotten better, we've moved from making a lot of assumptions that made it very easy to do the math to being able to quantify the things that we were once just able to assume. So for instance, you know, FIP versus deserved run average, the ideological underpinning behind those two numbers is similar, that there are some things that the pitcher can control and some that can't. So let's measure the things that he can control. But the data is so much more complicated for DRA. And I'm just curious, you know, what that evolution has been like from your end, you know, what some of the thorniest problems that we have become able to measure that have sort of thrown everything into chaos over the past few years have been.
Well, I think despite the fact that DRA is much more complicated to calculate and much more methodologically difficult to understand, the actual difference in terms of data between FIP and DRA is smaller than you might imagine. DRA doesn't, for example, use exit velocity. So it's actually not taking into account the newest suite of things. What really differentiates it is actually that difference in calculation, which for DRA is more robust and statistical and kind of based on formal statistical techniques that academics have kind of pioneered in the last few decades, whereas what FIP did is sort of back of the envelope approximating, and it does a good job. I don't want to blame FIP, but it's a little bit more fast and loose about how it does a calculation. So I guess to get to your question, I think that there has been this big evolution in how we do the data analysis that has actually been bigger than what the data itself is. It's been spurred in part by the fact that we have much more data available now. So if you try to do like a formal statistical model on only a few hundred data points, oftentimes it's not going to work very well. When you get from a few hundred data points is like how many plate appearances a hitter might have in a season. When you go from that to the next level down, modeling the pitch level data itself, for example, and there's a lot of signal there about, you know, for example, how fast pitchers are throwing. Each individual fastball that they throw is informative to some extent about their health or their ability at that moment. And so when you get to that next level and you're dealing now with thousands of data points or hundreds of exit velocities that are much more informative individually because they're not just did the hitter get on base or not, then you can start to actually employ the kind of statistical stuff that DRA uses and that front offices are using behind the scenes to calculate a lot of further downstream metrics and their versions of WAR, their versions of projections, and so on. And so I think that's been the bigger difference in the last few years is that now that we have this better, more granular, more informative data, we can take it to the next step. And instead of building approximations that are generally correct, like a FIP or a OPS, we can actually do the hard statistical work of modeling and employing the most recent tools that are out there to really comb through the data in a systematic and computerized way. Get the extra bits of accuracy that you can get out of that process.
Rob, you mentioned that you currently consult for a team as well as writing for public-facing sites, and I'm curious about how you handle that. I'm sure that you avoid writing about the team that employs you, and maybe we could do an analysis of all your articles to see which team you don't write about, and then we'll know which team you're currently consulting for. But between that or maybe that team being protective about what it shares with you, how do you navigate that unusual situation of kind of being an insider and an outsider at the same time and having different tools at your disposal in each of those jobs?
Yeah. Well, I generally try and keep them separate. So this is the third team that I've consulted for. And I have to say the first time it was a little tricky. I built kind of like a very significant wall between what I was doing for them and what I was doing in public. And it was complicated to keep them separate. So I just sort of totally didn't talk at all about anything that was on the margin there. With the most recent team, this is now my third go around, and I think I can't even remember how many years I've been doing this. So it's a little easier now to sort of be able to tell what they don't want me to talk about in public. It is still tricky in a way. You have to negotiate in advance, like this stuff is okay and this stuff isn't. Generally, I think you learn to kind of speak the way that, like, if you've ever heard a GM talk about the kinds of stuff that they hear from their analytics office, it's very similar, right? You can talk in these vague generalities that sound like they're informative, and sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. And then in terms of the writing stuff, I just try to, you know, not say anything that I know is false, right? So if I know from experience in my front office career that given article thesis that I might have that is well supported by the public data is actually not true, then, you know, don't write that article, because that's misleading your readers, and that's not a good thing to do. And similarly, like you mentioned, I don't write about the team that I work for and I try not to comment publicly on them, because I might know more about what's going on with them than the public does, and I don't, you know, it's a bad move for me to be talking about that. I try to be able to talk about the broad principles of the kinds of stuff that's going on in baseball, without betraying any particular significant detail about what I'm doing behind the front office curtain. It is a tough line to walk, but ultimately, as you get more experience, you learn what's valuable to the front office and what they don't really care that much about, and so it gets easier over time, and you start to be able to understand how they talk and what would be materially useful, for example, to another team in the division, and so that informs you about what not to say, essentially.
Let's end by having you look into the future a little bit. If God willing, we're all still doing these jobs and we're still doing this podcast in 5 years, and we have this conversation again, what do you think we're going to be talking about 5 years from now? What do you think are the next advances or the next big issues in quantitative baseball analysis?
That is a really tough question. I am concerned, I guess, at the moment that it's going to be a very similar conversation in 5 years, because I haven't been happy with the pace at which MLB AM is releasing new information to the public. I think in particular this last year, it was kind of disappointing to see that they hadn't put much new raw data out to the public. And so I think I've been vocal when people have asked me in saying that if they want to maintain a robust public baseball analysis sphere, then they're going to have to be more open about the data that they have. And although the teams, like I mentioned before, do have an incentive to keep that somewhat closed, I would argue they also have a strong, maybe even stronger incentive to open it up a little bit, at least so that they can give the public and analysts something to work with. I'm not going to say that we're close to tapped out with just PitchFX or just hit exit velocity or things like that. I know there's a lot more interesting work to be done there. But without further data release, we will sort of eventually run out of stuff that we can do with that data. And I'm not confident, based on the pace of data that's been unleashed so far by MLB AM, that we're going to get a lot more anytime soon. And it might not be a problem now, but I think in 5 years, the worry that I have is that we won't really be talking much about, like, the data analysis that we can do, or like the statistical things that we can tell about the league. We'll really just be talking about, like, whoa, this front office has employed this weird tactic, and we don't know if it's good or not. We don't have the data to tell. It's certainly strange. I mean, maybe it's really helping them, but we can't say. And I think that makes for a much less interesting sort of baseball media generally than what we had before, where maybe the teams were ahead of the public, but the gap was still kind of reasonable, and we were still able to ask interesting questions about what they were doing and to make discoveries about baseball in interesting ways. And I really am concerned about whether that will persist when the data that they're collecting is so much more advanced and so much more useful, and it's never really making it out to us in the public.
That's, I guess, in keeping with the state of baseball in general, kind of pessimistic and more of a meta commentary on what's happening than, you know, what we'd actually want to be talking about. But I think if nothing else, that's fitting. So, all right. Thanks for joining us, Rob. What are you working on? Do you have anything that you want to plug right now?
Just my Twitter account. You can follow me at @no_little_plans and keep up with my baseball analysis and my criminal justice and all sorts of other stuff that I write about. And that's it.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me on.
And that will do it for this week's episode of the Ringer MLB Show. Thanks to Zach and Ben for joining me, as always. Thanks to our guest, Rob Arthur. And thanks to Nolan Arenado, Miles Michaelis, and Aaron Hicks for giving us stuff to talk about. Thanks to Bobby Wagner for producing today's show. And thank you for listening. If you're going to spring training, please pour out a little bit of your pina colada for those of us stuck back up north. If you're staying home and watching college baseball, I can recommend LSU, Texas, Carolina, Clemson, and Stanford versus Cal State Fullerton. It's a big series to watch this weekend. So whichever action you choose to watch, enjoy it, and we'll see you next time.